Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Sarah Paretsky. Sarah will be in New Orleans for the upcoming mystery writer and fan convention, BoucherCon. We'll also talk with sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild, author of Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. And we'll hear from Steve Merlin and Alex Rook of Louisiana Books to Prisoners. This weekend brings us BoucherCon, the world's largest gathering of mystery writers and fans, which is especially large this year because so many folks want to visit New Orleans. One of the welcome guests to BoucherCon is bestselling author Sarah Paretsky, creator of Chicago private investigator V.I. Warshawski. As part of her visit, Sarah will be receiving the third Diana Pinkley Prize for a distinguished body of work in crime fiction, named for the New Orleans writer Diana Pinkley. Sarah Paretsky is a former president of the Mystery Writers of America, the founder of Sisters in Crime, as well as the author of a stirring memoir, Writing in an Age of Silence. So, Sarah Paretsky, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks. It's good to be here, Susan.
You've been writing about your adopted hometown of Chicago for a long time, and V.I. has definitely made a prominent place for herself in it. She's grown over the years, and that seems very important to you, that she's grown along with the city.
She's changed as the city has changed, and also as life for women in America has changed, I would say. The battles she had to fight when she first started were the ones that I was fighting as part of the first generation of women to be entering the professions in large numbers and getting ourselves heard, being taken seriously, trying to get more than 59 cents on the male dollar. We're up to 77 cents. I'm so excited.
I know. Now, one of the things I've always admired about V.I. is that in addition to her physical fearlessness, but I do like that she's aging a little bit and it takes a bit of a toll on her, is her smarts. She follows the money. She was never afraid of money, as so many are. And you've done a wonderful thing with her by teaching women so much about the way money works, the way big cities work, just the way things get done in the world.
Well, that's very kind of you. I think these are issues that I struggle with personally, which is probably why they are front and center in my books. Right now, I'm in the middle of trying to preserve one of the few green spaces that we have. I live in the city of Chicago, not in the suburbs, and green spaces in urban life are precious. And we have a wealthy consortium from out of town who wants to turn it into an amusement park. And so just trying to get hold of all of the different players and the murkiness of Chicago politics and how decisions are made. There are days when I just feel like lying on the floor and drumming my heels up and down and thinking, oh, I wish I was the girl detective. I would sort this out and teach those bad boys a lesson or two.
Well, the other thing about V.I. that I like is that she likes her creature comforts. She likes good scotch and she likes high fashion.
You know, as I've gotten older, I no longer can really tolerate alcohol, which is sad. And I unconsciously was cutting back on V.I.'s drinking. And then I got this charming letter from a man in England who said he was president of the Armagnac Society. And I thought, oh, only in England would there be an Armagnac Society for the president. And he wrote me and he said, in your early books, V.I. drank lots of lovely Armagnac, and now she hardly drinks at all. What happened? And I thought, oh, no, you know, she gets beat up. She takes all these hits, and I've deprived her of alcohol. So now I make a conscious effort to give her lovely drinks in every book.
You better be in training before you come down to New Orleans. You know that.
That's what they tell me. I don't know. I'm not sure I'm woman enough for this. I have not been in New Orleans since before Katrina, which is a sad thing to say. So I am really, really looking forward to seeing what the city looks like now.
Well, it'll be exciting and interesting. It always is when people come here. Now, another thing about VI is that you've given her this marvelous family of relationships, this family of choice. I mean, she's fiercely loyal to the family she has left, but she has so many longtime wonderful friends, Lottie Herschel, Max Lowenthal, her neighbor, Mr. Contreras. I was recently with a group of women talking about your books, and everyone's worried about Mr. Contreras because he's getting up there.
Yes.
And her dogs. And her interesting boyfriends.
Well, you know, when I started the series, I was about 30 and VI was roughly the same age. And I thought, oh, she's going to age through time. None of this being like Spencer forever hovering around 40 and being a Korean War veteran. But I didn't realize the toll the time takes on the body. And I have to confess that I'm cheating now. So I'm almost 70, but VI is only 50. So she's aged 20 years for my 35 years. And I think part of this is I'm also at an age where there's just a lot of loss, either death or real sad diminishment of mental powers among the people that I'm closest to. I don't want that in my fictional world. I want my fictional world to comfort me and hopefully to comfort readers. So, yeah, Mr. Contreras, he must be 120, but he's going to keep on trucking. And Lottie Herschel, she shouldn't be in an operating room, but I dare you to be the person that takes that scalpel from her. And the dogs, of course, you know, I've buried 3 golden retrievers while I've been writing VI, and each one is just so much grief. I'm just not going to do that. My dogs are ageless.
I agree. I totally agree. Well, one of my friends said that the thing she loved the most about VI was that she had a regular life, you know? She worried about what to wear. She cooked her own dinner. You know, you hear about her fatigue and her energy, and she goes to play basketball or, you know, whatever. She has a regular life in addition to her work. And one never doubts that VI is part of a community. And you have been such an important part of a community of writers. You've worked with all kinds of causes, equity for women writers. That was behind the founding of Sisters in Crime. And I often think the Vita count of today had such roots in those efforts of just keeping track.
Yes, that was a tough issue to try to come to grips with, but it was easier in the world before ebooks and online pirating and so on, because you could actually monitor how many books were published and you could monitor all of the review outlets. It took elbow grease, but not hacker's skill to follow it all over. And so we were able to get real data and show places like the New York Times or LA Times, the big influential review outlets, that a mystery by a man was 7 times more likely to be reviewed than a mystery by a woman. And that has really serious financial consequences because libraries are our biggest buyers and they buy based on seeing national reviews. I was trying to address this in a different aspect of this when I was president of the Mystery Writers of America, because African-American writers have really been hit the hardest by the imploding of the publishing world and the disappearance of independent bookstores. Proportionately more African-American mystery writers have lost publishing outlets compared to white writers. But grappling with this, trying to get hard numbers, trying to get things that we could show the publishing industry and review organizations, it's just a lot harder now because it's so amorphous. It's so much harder to keep track of.
Right. The data seems to stretch out to infinity and beyond. You know? So what does a gathering like BoucherCon mean to you? You've written so many books. You've done so many things like this. What is the renewing quality that you get from a gathering like this?
Yeah, the writing life is a lonely life, and I think that's why writers go to conferences. And the BoucherCon is the oldest. It's still, in my opinion, the most important. You could go to a mystery conference every week if you wanted to. But for me, it's a chance to see people that I only get to see once or twice a year and catch up and just feel part of an enterprise, maybe, that I'm not doing this on my own, that I'm with a group of people who all share my passion for the written word and for reading and writing.
And you're all such characters, I have to say. Well, I, for one, would like to thank you for your work. VI has been a longtime companion of mine, and she's inspired me a great deal.
Well, that's very gracious of you. And I have to say I'm incredibly honored to be receiving the Diana Pinkley Award. It means a huge amount to me. So thank you, too, for your role in that.
Quite welcome. We've been talking with the distinguished crime writer Sarah Paretsky, author of the V.I. Warshawski series and winner of this year's Pinkley Prize for Crime Fiction. She will receive that award Saturday, September 17th at 6 at the Louisiana Humanities Center, 938 Lafayette Street. If you'd like to attend, RSVP to WNBAofNOLA@gmail.com. Sarah, thank you so much.
Glad to be here, Susan.
Arlie Russell Hochschild is Professor Emerita of Sociology at the University of Berkeley. Even if you haven't read her work, chances are some aspect of it has touched your life. She's an expert in the sociology of feelings and emotions. She's the author of The Second Shift, The Time Bind, The Managed Heart, and The Outsourced Self. Today, we'll be talking about her most recent book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. Arlie Hochschild, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Now, this book, Searching for Voices on the American Right, took you 5 years. It took you out of your comfort zone a bit. And the place you put at the heart of your research is Lake Charles, Louisiana.
That's right.
So what were some of the factors that influenced you in choosing our state and that particular city?
You know, I had begun to really be concerned about the growing political divide in our country. We were turning into two Americas, and positions on each side had not been harder, grown harder in the last four decades, and more separate. And there was more animosity and name-calling and contempt. And so it occurred to me that there were a lot of reasons for this, but one was that we're living in different parts of the country. And there's this book called The Big Sort, which indicates that when we move, it isn't just for nicer climates or better jobs, it's for political compatibility. So we're living in these bubbles, separate bubbles. I live in Berkeley, California, a state that voted Democratic much of the time, last two elections. I thought, where is a place most different from Berkeley, California, that I could go so that I could get out of my bubble and come to another bubble and get to know the people in it? And the right has grown most in the South, and it's most among older white people. And so I thought that's where I should go. I should go to Louisiana, which in the last two elections among whites has voted more conservative than the South as a whole. So that's why from Berkeley to Lake Charles.
Now, one of the things I love about the way you work is that you don't just fly in and out of a place. You stay there and participate in the life of the people that you're studying. You went to gumbo cook-offs, you went fishing, you went to church services, you went to a boat parade, and you picked a place with great cooks and great food. That's for sure.
You know, I have never had more fun doing research and really never had a more interesting, surprising, enjoyable experience. I met some incredibly wonderful people and made new friends.
So tell us about some of them.
Well, one of them was a man who had lived for a long time in Bayou Corn. And in 2012, he suffered one of the worst industrial accidents in the country, the Bayou Corn sinkhole, and that began the size of a house lot and gradually extended to some 32 acres. And he looked out over his lawn, and methane gas was rising. It looked like Alka-Seltzer tablets in some of the rain puddles when it rained. So his house was destroyed, as was that of some 360 people. And the community was evacuated. So it was a disaster. And this man, very nice, very personable, is completely, ardently Tea Party and voted for Governor Jindal twice with enthusiasm and had not been much of an environmentalist before this. And so after this disaster, I happened to be attending a environmental rally in the State House steps and saw him give a talk, his voice cracking with emotion. I became very interested in how this man, ardent Tea Party, and really takes a very dim view of the federal government and feels it's more of a problem than solution to many issues, how he was going to respond to an accident that was clearly caused by Texas Brine, which was a company that was very under-regulated. How would he put together the disaster he had suffered with his own dim view of a government agency that would regulate industry? He has become an environmental activist, part of the Green Army, and has given many talks. So he's really become an activist and a critic of the Tea Party that it doesn't take on environmental issues. But with the next election, he's planning to vote for Donald Trump, who plans to abolish the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, I love the letters you write to your liberal and conservative friends at the end of the book about how we can best reach out to one another. And I so admire your hope for dialogue, because in this divisive election with so much talk about walls and division, you urge people to get past their own empathy walls and reach out to people on the other side.
You know, if we all did it, if each one picked only one other person with whom they fundamentally disagree and really took their own alarm system off and tried to get to know that person, doesn't mean you change your views, but it means you open your appreciation for them. And it's an extraordinary and wonderful thing to do. I feel much larger having done it. And the people I met were very generous and met me more than halfway.
Well, it's a great pleasure to read this book, and it is truly eye-opening. We've been talking with Arlie Russell Hochschild, whose new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. You can meet her Thursday, September 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Arlie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
I am so happy to welcome Steve Merlin and Alex Rook of Louisiana Books to Prisoners to The Reading Life. Steve has been working with Louisiana Books to Prisoners since 2009. He's currently an investigator at an indigent defense law firm in New Orleans, which is work that came directly out of conversations and connections from Books to Prisoners. With Steve is Alex Rook, who relocated to New Orleans in 2012 to teach English at Tulane. Alex first learned of the organization at a zine reading on campus and has been working with them for about 2 years. Steve, Alex, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you so much for having us here.
Oh, it's great. Now, Steve, tell us a little bit about the history of the organization.
It was originally founded in 2003 before the storm and was on Jane Place in Mid-City. During the storm, the building that it was in was pretty badly damaged, and after the storm, it was restarted in about 2006 by a group of folks. It was originally in the back of the Iron Rail, which is a bookstore on Marigny, in the Marigny, and it was there for a couple of years and then moved back to Jane Place and is now in a house in the 7th Ward.
So this version is 10 years old this year.
We are, actually.
That's pretty amazing.
It is.
I noticed that you sent out last year almost 1,800 packages, right?
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
It's been increasing every year. I think when I first got involved, it was something more like 700 or 800, and we would often have to shut down for the summer because mm-hmm. of the heat and other issues. We were constantly running out of money, and that really cut into our ability to send books. But we became a 501c3, I think about 5 years ago, and we've been grant-funded ever since, and that has really changed things.
Now, Steve, you guys have regular work nights every Sunday from 4 to 7 at 2523 George Nick Connor Drive. Exactly. So tell us what that typical work night would be like.
A work night is where we actually come together and answer the letters that we're getting. We currently serve 4 states. We serve Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, and Arkansas. We also send books to female-identified or women prisoners all over the country. And we generally will sometimes keep up with folks who have been incarcerated in those states and might be moved. Like, sometimes we have folks who are in federal institutions and they get moved somewhere else. And we'll usually keep up with them for a little while if they keep writing us. And so during a work night, we'll come together and we have these letters that people have sent us. And the letters will say, you know, I'm looking for this kind of book, or this is what I'm interested in. And we'll try and pick something from the library that we have, which is all donated books. And we'll pack those up and send them back out. And sometimes we may have someone who writes us for years repeatedly. We may have someone who only writes once or twice.
Prisoners can only make requests so often, am I right?
Yeah, some of that is that prisons may have a restriction about how often they can get packages. It's really more about our resources. When we first started, we were trying to serve all 50 states, and we've just had to gradually contract. You know, there were states like California and Texas that have prison books programs that serve only those states. And so we stopped serving California and Texas. And then at a certain point, we contracted from the other 48 states down to just the Southeast and then to just the 4 states we serve now. And it was largely a resource question. We were getting to a point where we had a backlog that I think at the worst was almost 2 years long. So it would take 2 years between the time that we got a letter before we would get to it. And in that time, people have moved, people have been released. You know, it was just this enormous effort to get books to anybody.
That's very disheartening. Now, you two are part of the collective that keeps Louisiana Books to Prisoners going, but anyone can come and volunteer. And in addition to that, anyone can donate books, and they can leave them anytime at the shelves outside 2523 George Nick Connor Drive.
That's true. Although things that we need more than books right now, because honestly, we have an incredibly large library, we really need folks to come and volunteer on Sundays at the work nights, which again are at that same address from 4 to 7 on Sundays. And we always need money. Mm-hmm. And I hate to be crass about it, but our biggest expense is postage. Everyone who works with Books to Prisoners is a volunteer. Virtually all of our books are donated, but there's no break for us on postage. And when we do buy books, especially GED guides or dictionaries, that can be quite expensive.
Of course. And they can donate through your website, and that is lab2p.org. And you can email bookstoprisoners@gmail.com. You have something coming up that's going to be a lot of fun in conjunction with the Young Leadership Council's One Book, One New Orleans project.
We have a book drive. It's called Books and Brews, a book drive for Louisiana Books to Prisoners. It's September 24th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Second Line Brewing, which is 433 North Bernadette Street in New Orleans.
So you will take a few more books.
We will. And there are some specific things that we always need. You know, we go through dictionaries almost as fast as we can get them. Any kind of trade book, and again, these all have to be soft cover, which is sometimes right. The trouble. Anything about home repair, anything about basic trade skills, auto mechanics, things like that. That's incredibly popular. How to draw, art books, dictionaries. Native American history is a popular one. We had a real need for Black American history, but we got an amazing donation from the Amistad Library that we're still going through. But that will come to an end, and eventually we'll need it. It may seem somewhat superficial to send a book, and it may not seem like very much, but I think one point that is important is that these folks are coming home. And when people start writing to us, it's often because they're at a point in their life that they're tired of making the same choices and they're really looking for something different. And they may know that they're going to come out of prison with a felony record and it's going to be incredibly difficult for them to find work and to not get stuck in that cycle where they're going to end up back in prison. And oftentimes people are saying, I want to get an education, I want to get a trade, I really want to move forward in my life because I'm tired of this and this isn't what I want for myself. These are community members who are going to come home and they are looking for support because they want to make a change.
That's the great thing about books. They do change lives. They do make people's lives better in so many ways that we can hardly imagine sometimes. We've been talking with Steve Merlin and Alex Rook of Louisiana Books to Prisoners. Don't forget the Louisiana Books to Prisoners book drive Saturday, September 24th from 1 to 3 at Second Line Brewing, 433 North Bernadotte Street. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Brendan Jones discusses The Alaskan Laundry, Wednesday, September 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library present Mystery Writers Mix and Mingle, Wednesday, September 14th at 9 at Ladder Library, with writers R.L. Stine, Heather Graham, Alexandra Sokoloff, Craig Robertson, Harley Jane Kozak, David Morell, Lissa Price, Jeffrey Seeker, and Greg Heron. For tickets, visit friendsnola.com. Or call 910-520-4546. Off the Shelf, an arts and literary market, takes place Saturday, September 17th from 10 to 3 at Solo Espresso, 1301 Poland Street. Vendors include Disorder Press, The Stacks, Constance, The New Orleans Review, Alicia Brown, and Maple Street Bookshop. Journalist and historian Robert Mann presents See How They Run, Robert Mann on the 2016 Elections, Saturday, September 17th at 3 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Sarah Paretsky, accepts the Pinkley Prize for a distinguished body of work in crime fiction, along with fellow prize winner Christine Carbo, author of The Wild Inside, winner of the Pinkley Prize for debut novel, Saturday, September 17th at 6 at the Louisiana Humanities Center at Turner's Hall, 938 Lafayette Street. Free, but seating is limited. RSVP to WNBAofNOLA@gmail.com. Ellen Byron debuts her new book, Body on the Bayou, Saturday, September 17th at 6 at the Hall Barnett Gallery, 237 Charter Street. Poet Maria Kelson, author of How Long She'll Last in This World and Flexible Bones, reads and signs her work Sunday, September 18th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Writer Edgar Carrot, author of The Seven Good Years, kicks off the cultural season at the Jewish Community Center Monday, September 19th at 7 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center. The Fantasy Book Club discusses The Obelisk Gate by N.K. Jemisin, Monday, September 19th at 7 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. Restaurateur T. Martin discusses and signs her new book, Miss Ella of Commander's Palace, with writer John Pope, Tuesday, September 20th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Arlie Russell Hochschild, discusses and signs Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, Thursday, September 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guests, Steve Merlin and Alex Rook, will be part of a Louisiana Books to Prisoners book drive Saturday, September 24th from 1 to 3 at Second Line Brewing, 433 North Bernadotte Street. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.